Hi and hello, Watch fans, and welcome to another edition of The Real Time Show with me, your friendly neighborhood watchmaker, Rob Nuds, my co-host, Alan Ben-Joseph, and our resident provocateur, David Vauchet. We are all spread around Europe as usual, but coming together in the virtual studio to discuss questions in our mailbag from our dedicated listeners. Now, before we get going, we do have a bit of an announcement to make. Today is actually the 151st episode of The Real Time Show, and having made it to 150 episodes, in our current publishing format, we have decided it is time to make a slight alteration in anticipation of some bigger changes coming to The Real Time Show shortly down the line. So instead of being published on Tuesdays and Thursdays and alternating between Q&A and interviews and occasionally articles and article analysis shows, we're now going to have one show a week on Sundays. So it's your Sunday morning coffee show, and it's going to be Q&A, interview, article and article analysis. So we're now going to roll together the article and the article analysis show. So you're going to get to listen to one of David's tirades, and then immediately afterwards, you're going to hear our discussion about that article. So that's going to become a fully fledged episode type in its own right. We're going to focus on creating the best quality content that we can. And in the meantime, with this reduced frequency, we're going to focus on building up the network and fleshing out the site and adding more features for our listeners to enjoy. We hope you like this. If you don't, you can let us know, of course, via the usual channels, either via Instagram or via emails, or you can just stand outside our houses and throw stones at the window until we answer, if you prefer. That's enough of that for an announcement. David, Alan, welcome to the studio.
Whoop, 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 whoop. 150. Also, thanks to David. Thank you, David, for all the efforts you're doing behind the scenes, on air, articles, and all the help that you give in the community as well. Thank you to our dear listeners for filling our mailbag, as it's still bursting at the seams, as Rob always says. I think you should actually trademark that, Rob. We're doing it, A, because you guys and gals listening said that you can't keep up with the quantity, but also in the light of the upcoming cool changes, read growth, we are gearing to having more fun. How are you, David?
Fantastic. Always great to be here with you two talking watches. And just to give viewers an idea of how good Rob has gotten at this, during that whole introduction, he only stuttered once. That's impressive. I was thinking the whole time you were talking, Rob, you're going to stutter, and you didn't. So very impressive stuff. You're clearly born to be a podcast host.
Probably because I like the sound of my own voice too much, but I'm getting used to it now after 150 goes around, but I can't wait for the next 150. Of course, it will probably take us a little bit longer to get to 300. Now we're reducing the frequency. But as Alan says, we do actually have the capacity to continue with the same amount of content, but we'd like to diversify the content that we're offering the network. So it's a more holistic experience, and there's much more things to get excited about and discuss. And it will be a minimum of one piece of content. Alan was very keen that I make this clear. When we go to fairs, for example, we might drop bonus episodes here, there, and everywhere to make sure that you are kept as fully abreast of everything that's happening in the industry as we're possibly able to keep you. Let us now look into the mailbag, because I'm not sure I can trademark bursting at the seams, Alan. It's a pretty common thing to say, so I'll try, but expect a rejection. First question is actually for you, my dear friend in Amsterdam. While you were chatting with the podcast guru of the Netherlands himself off air, David and I were talking about the latest release from Leica, the brand better known for its cameras, and we wanted to have a little discussion about it. We wanted to hear your opinion first, as someone who has likely dealt with both the Leica camera product and also the Leica watch product.
Okay, I truly did not hear you guys chatting, because I was indeed saying goodbye to my friend Frederick, who was one third of the trio of Mannen van de Tijd. It's the best podcast in Dutch about watches. It's funny that you actually speak about Leica, because I had an in-depth and deep discussion with Rob and I, my mutual friend Gerard Nijenbrinks of Fratello, whom I hang out with during the last Red Bar Crew event in Amsterdam a few days ago. He's a big Leica fan, or Leica. Don't actually know how you pronounce that. It's probably German, so it's Leica. And he went to visit the store, which is in the same street as my boutique. And we had a discussion about the watches. So he and I were unanimous. I loved Generation 1, Then they made a blacked out version of these two models. I forgot the references, but I believe it was L1 or something, if I remember correctly. And I assume you guys are talking about the newest one with the integrated bracelet.
Yes. And actually, but you bring up a good point before you get to your thoughts on that, because one of the things I said to Rob, and I'm just looking these up now, it was indeed the L1 and L2 watches. They were really good looking, I thought. The movements were really well done, but they seem to have kind of come and gone. So maybe they were limited. Maybe I'm just not really sure what happened. It's like we got the announcements and then that was it. So do you have any insight on what happened with that first generation, Alan?
So when that store opened, it was only a few months ago, I visited them. They actually had those watches in stock. But as you often have that issue in monobrand boutiques, there is a lot of ignorance. So lack of knowledge, I mean by that. And lack of passion. They were utterly clueless about the watches when I came in. I stepped in again a few months later. I said, you know what? They're new. Let me give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they didn't have their training. So I went in again. Same issue. The new watches were in stock. So the ZM versions you guys are probably talking about. And they still did not know much. I tried to tell them, hey, I'm a colleague down the street. If you guys need any help sizing bracelets, because all the monobrand boutiques around us, fashion brands, both watch retailers, often don't know how to size straps. And for the quartz watches, they have no idea how to change batteries. So we do that a lot for our colleagues here. So I offered them that. I'm like, hey, I'm just down the street. If you ever need help, feel welcome. We're here. We're colleagues. We need to help each other. But they were a bit passive in responding. And when I said that, I also have an awesome podcast about watches. And we tried to reach HQ to ask them to add us to the press list. Maybe we can do an interview or review the watches. Zero response. And they were very passive on that. So that diminished my enthusiasm for the brand a bit. Now, the watch, I think, is interesting. It's modern. It's new. It gives me a bit of brown vibes. The bracelet is cool. It also raised memories of the new Louis Vuitton tambour in my mind. I don't know why, because they don't really look alike. Price, I don't remember, but wasn't it around 6, 7, 8 or something, guys? Do you know?
Yeah, exactly right. It's between 6, 8 and 8.1, I think, depending on the material and whatnot. And funnily, you should mention the tambour, because both David and I agree that it does have tambour vibes. I think it's mostly to do with the central lug, perhaps, and the way that it flows from the case. I see a little bit of the streamliner in the bracelet as well, just the edges, which I'm a big fan of. But yeah, let's, I think you said brown. I think we say braun in English, even though you write like we would say brown in German, I guess. But you mean the radio maker and the guys that just released a new special edition with Hodinkee, which is actually quite cute, although not sold out, as seems to be the way of things these days. Let's talk about this watch. This watch as a watch is pretty damn nice. There's a lot of nice details. I noticed this on the previous ZM1 and the ZM2. This is the ZM11 that we're discussing here, and it is really well made. Let's take the black dial with the red accents just to study, because it's quite a good case study. That dial, firstly, beautiful applied numerals. Great finishing on the hands. The hands of the ZM1 and 2 were also a high point, really beautifully done, very unusually shaped. These ones were a bit more standard, but they are very, very nicely realized. That dial with those cut-throughs, which has the little subtle red core, as it were, and black surface, is really nice, especially when you look at the date window, how they've done that, how they've stepped down to the date window. And you've got a date wheel in there with a custom font, which matches the overall Teutonic vibe of the whole thing. And then you have this beautifully finished case with an unusual, I don't know, what would you call that crown? Would you call it like a turbine crown or something along those lines, Alan?
Tambour crown. So it's it's a tambour, a drum, so it's not a straight edge drum or a barrel drum. But if you need to take a shape or form, I would call it trapezium-ish shaped.
You know what it looks like? It looks like a bun case. You know, when you're making little buns in the oven, it looks like a little bun case.
Yeah, yeah, for muffins or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll call it a muffin case crown. It's a cute one. It's got some lovely touches. I mean, the strap release button on the back obviously recalls the iconic red dot of Leica, and that's a little push button release, which just, it's the kind of thing that watch brands would be maybe reluctant to try and get away with. It's a little bit too cutesy, but for Leica, it's okay. Now, the movement architecture and design is right up my street. It's very, very aggressive and industrial. It's got pretty brutalist finishing on it, but it looks great. It's really in keeping with the design of the watch, with its heritage as a German brand. I am a fan of this watch, but what I'm not a fan of, even though I like the brand of Leica, is the fact that this is a Leica watch. If this were, same with the ZM1 and 2, if this were a watch series from a new watch brand, I would be far more likely to put my cash somewhere near to it. I wouldn't necessarily say I'd slap it down on there, because 6.8 to 8.1 is a lot of money. Is it worth it? Well, the movement surely wasn't cheap to develop. It's proprietary for Leica. That's something nice. That's something special. I wonder how much I'm paying for the Leica name, which is the one thing I don't like about it. Do you know what I mean when I say I don't want it to be a Leica watch? I'd rather it were a Ben Joseph, for example.
I kind of get that, but I guess, so before I get to your point, Rob, just quick nomenclature clarification. I want to correct myself. I think originally I was looking at the Hodinkee release. They were called L1 and L2, and it looks like now Leica has changed that to ZM1 and ZM2 to then go with ZM11. So both of you correct me if I'm wrong, or someone in the audience correct me, but I think that's the new nomenclature. So now going to the ZM11, I will quickly say that, you know, I guess I'm going to go back to, quote, fashion watches every time we do one of these. But my overarching message is, if you're going to do it properly. So there was a recent release from Dior, which was apparently a historical release. I don't even remember the name, actually. It wasn't great at all. But this is great. And maybe you don't like it subjectively for the looks of it, but you cannot deny that whoever was put in charge of the watch projects at Leica knew what they were doing, and said, I'm going to do this to the best of my abilities, and probably stretch the budget a little bit, given what was done. So now to your question, Rob, do I care that it's a Leica? Well, you know, photography is one of those things I'm interested in, but I'm trying to avoid because it's another really expensive hobby. So I don't have that background. But I also think, too, that I am far enough along in my watch journey to accept a couple of things. The first being that if you buy a watch, you shouldn't expect to get, it's not an investment, basically. So if I buy a watch, it's because I like it as an object. And the second thing is that I am kind of comfortable saying that, okay, for these specs, you should pay this. For these specs, you should pay that. And frankly, like, specs that you're getting for, call it, we'll just average it out, 7,500 euros is pretty freaking good. Like, I don't think you can argue with what you're actually getting for the money here. So my point of view, I actually think it's better that it's Leica, because there is some cachet behind the brand. I think if it were someone just trying to get started, be a much, much tougher sell, even with the specs that are being presented.
Well said, David, because the first thing that came to mind is indeed the parallel to fashion houses and jewelers that are making watches. Should they? Shouldn't they? So that was interesting. Rob, I feel you. If it wasn't a caliber developed by Chronod, I would say, hey, they're bringing Leica quality and know-how to watchmaking. Could be interesting. But then Montblanc comes to mind. Montblanc makes benchmark writing instruments. Should they make watches? Shouldn't they? And then obviously they had the Richemont mother company, and then they plugged in Minerva. So they made a bit of a mishmash there. Now, Leica seems a bit of an enigma, mystery. I believe they're family owned or independent. I want to know, why are they making watches? Is it a calling? Why is it that they feel that they wanted to make watches? What I love, they bring something new to the game, to the table. And I love the fact that it's not a one-day fly. It's not just one hit. They tried it with the L1 and L2, or ZM1, ZM2 now that it's called. They are obviously on a mission. And you can't compare these watches to anything. And apparently they're putting a standard of quality. That's why they teamed up with Chronode. Before I ask you, Rob, a question as a watchmaker, comparing the watches, I also got a bit of Aorus ProPilot X vibes on the bracelet, but it is definitely different and indeed a bit of a streamliner. And we obviously have to find a way to put this in context with Nomos from Glashütte. The only model that might give you that vibe is the Autobahn, but doesn't even come close. And this is a compliment to Leica, because they created a new watch. And how freaking difficult is that today? And the dial, do you think they resemble a shutter of a camera? Or
yeah, that could be it. That could be it. I mean, the dials are one of the things that I am really keen on. I think that it's a clever way to bring color into the display without it being overbearing. It's especially obvious on the black and red one, I would say. The other ones don't do exactly the same thing. They don't hide that color in the middle of the dial. That is something I haven't really seen before, I don't think. And as I said, I think it's really obvious and really, really nice to see around the date window, because you can see the levels of the dial and how it's constructed. And you're absolutely right. They've made a new watch. Now, is it completely unique in its appearance? No, obviously not, because we all got Tambor vibes from it the minute we looked at it. Does it have callbacks to other watch designs? Yeah, of course it does. But is it a worthwhile addition to the watchmaking game? I think it is. And like I said, if it weren't for the name on the dial, I'd be more inclined to take it seriously. As for the movement, now this is, yeah, it's not cheap, but it's also not the most expensive movement Leica's ever relied upon. This is a Chronode-made caliber. As you said, I would say from its architecture, it appears to be a modified C102 caliber, which is their base automatic, which is used by many brands around the industry, like Laventure or Sapanyeva or Chapek, even to power some of their chronographs with dial side complications. It's a nice movement. It's a good one. The cost of this finished as it is would probably be around 1,500 francs to the brand. That's probably what it would cost, roughly. The case would certainly cost quite a lot for a case, because it's extremely nicely machined. You only need to look at the back side of it and appreciate the finishing as it transitions from the flat surface around the crystal up to the curvature of the lugs. I mean, that is absolutely flawlessly done. It's expert work. I would say that as a product, it's streets ahead of a lot of things below its price point, for sure, and it's touching some above it as well. Talking of that, I have a question for you both about the Tambor. And David, I see your hand up, but we'll get back to your point afterwards, because we still have a lot to discuss about this watch, so it would seem. But the Tambor, for a steel one, is what, 20K? Around that, 19,500? Which one is better value, the Leica or the Tambor? Discuss.
Okay. I'm going to put the points I was going to make aside to talk about this. You know, as far as design, there's clearly a lot of borrowing that happens in the industry, but I'm curious how that happened. Like, on one hand, it's just way too coincidental. They look so similar. But on the other hand, as far as I know, LVMH doesn't own Leica, right? So I don't know how that cross-pollination happened. But let's set that aside. You know, you're paying basically, what, two and a half times? Something along those lines for the Louis Vuitton versus the Leica. And I know that I'm sort of off buying watches for a while, but if I were to buy watches, I think the Tambor would be quite high up on the list, because it just looks like a nice object. But, you know, if you ask me to choose, and there is the money's obviously the most practical consideration here, I think I'd go with the Leica, actually, because it's the most, like, legitimate. And not saying that, you know, the Louis Vuitton colleagues didn't spend a ton of time on the Tambor, they did. But just, like, there's something about the Leica where it's like, if you want to sort of say something about yourself, the Louis Vuitton says one thing. The Leica says, you know, I like design, I like nicely made things. And that was one of the points I was going to make, actually, was that, you know, who is Alan asked, like, who is this for? well, it's a very niche audience, but like if you can imagine, you know, an architect who's set up his own firm or his or her own firm who is brand agnostic because they just like well-made things, they like design, they probably own a couple of Leica cameras. This is the type of thing that they would wear with their, like, you know, slim fit black shirt and pants, their, you know, acetate glasses. They'd have a Leica on their wrist while they're designing their next project, you know? So I think that that type of evocative imagery says something about the watch, and I think ultimately is what would make me choose that over the Louis Vuitton. Alan, what do you think?
Interesting. I kind of want to refrain from answering because I haven't had them both in my hands, either separately or together. But for the sake of this game, for myself, definitely Leica. Titanium, underdog. It's a connoisseur's brand for cameras. They try to be the connoisseur watchmaker for watch enthusiasts. You can only get that vibe by reading the text on their website. They treat their visitors to their website with respect. They tell you who developed the caliber. They're talking about chamfering and etc. So you see that they're at an intellectual level. I love what Jean Arnault is doing at La Fabrique du Temps and Louis Vuitton. I love what he did with the Louis Vuitton Independence Award. A lot of passion, a lot of love. But me, myself, I don't click with Louis Vuitton. I've never owned an item from that brand. I don't think I'll ever will. Doesn't mean that it's not an amazing brand. And even though I love Off-White collabs with Nike, I didn't really like anything that Virgil Abloh did with Vuitton. I love Pharrell's music. I like his choice in watches, but still everything he does with Vuitton doesn't resonate with me. Because they also made a titanium version next to their steel version, that shows that they're taking this game very serious, this watchmaking game, and watch enthusiasts, because it's not commercial to make an additional model in titanium. You could have easily made that black dial of the titanium version in steel. Will probably sell more watches even. And I hope that they keep on this journey of ultra quality, very intellectual designs, and respecting watch collectors and watch nerds. And I hope that the next generation will be black, and that they don't do DLC or PVD, but go the ceramic route. Matte finished ceramic version in black of the ZM11. If they do that, I salute Leica.
Oh, that'd be so fantastic. Yeah, you know, it's, again, not knowing really anything about Leica, I don't know how much ceramic plays into their products, but, you know, going back to this image I have of like a successful architect wearing it, I think, yeah, an all black matte ceramic watch would be awesome, or even just hints of ceramic, you know, like the bezel, maybe the crown. But yeah, I think this type of watch definitely is a great platform that would seem to lend itself to other ways of interpreting it, basically. So yeah, I think that's just another point in Leica's favor. And I would say, commenting on what Alan said about us not having these watches, now, I know Rob and Alan early on in TRTS's history used to do product reviews. So if anyone has a hookup at Leica, or if anyone at Leica is listening to this, it would be awesome if we could get, you know, ZM11 or even the 1 and 2 in for testing, because my hypothesis going into it is it would be a very positive review. Obviously, we'd want to handle it before making that verdict. But yeah, this is something I would love to get some in-person impressions of.
I'm sure we can get one in for review. It's a wonderful looking watch, and we would all love to have it on our wrists. Let's take one of the topics that we discussed here and transition to a question from the mailbag, and that's the movement. Now, we mentioned that this movement from Leica is a chronoed developed caliber. Leica has made more ambitious movements in the past with its ZM1 and ZM2. This is more run-of-the-mill fare. More and more brands are turning to chronoed specifically to supply them with very good quality proprietary movements. Now, while I support that, and I think that's a great way for independent brands to step up their horological quality to offer a more exciting watch that has a movement that can't be had anywhere else in it for a reasonable price, We have a question from Waki in the mailbag, and he says, should the likes of Frederik Constant and Nomos Glacéter consider selling their movements to other brands? What would be the pros and cons of this? And I see that a similar approach with Ming hasn't worked out too badly for Schwarz-Etienne. Now, this is a nice transitional question because it takes us from an over-reliance, perhaps, on a very few movement manufacturers that are willing to make proprietary calibers for brands such as Chronode or Concepto or Le Cercle de Temps. David, I can't remember how you pronounce it or whatever, but don't kill me for that. What do you guys think about existing independent brands or group brands that make their own movements that aren't available in any other watches currently, selling them to brands? Would it be required for the movement seller and the brand buying the movement to have some kind of spiritual connection, should we say, or like a shared reason for being?
First of all, if I may, Worky, we love you. Rob knew you. Your reputation preceded you. We've been together for 14 months, 15 months, 16 months, I don't know, almost a year and a half in the network, the TRTS network. It's a joy to have met you. Dear listeners, if you want a bit of humor fused with intellect, just join the TRTS just for Worky. His comments are sharp as a knife, sword. They'll cut through you, any watch, any criticism. Nobody and anybody is safe from Worky. Thank you, Worky, and thank you for these great questions on the serious note, a serious side of things. While I have the mic, I'll just jump in. Because Worky asked this question already in one of the interviews that we did with the CEOs. So I'm happy that we're actually dealing this on a more of a helicopter view, looking at the whole industry. So it's a very difficult decision. So I would say if a brand is ramping up with their own production of own calibers and they need to get that critical mass, on average, you hear a lot of brands saying, if you don't make 30,000 calibers, it's not really viable and commercially viable to make these calibers. So if you need to ramp up, like Schwarz-Etienne did with Ming, for example, it makes a lot of sense. If you're new to the game, I also think it makes sense to sell your calibers as a watchmaker, because Chronode obviously is just a watchmaker. So that's a different ballgame. But Worky specifically asks if watch brands that develop their own calibers should also sell their calibers to another brand. Take, for example, Zenith, right? Rolex used a very long time El Primero calibers as a base for their Rolex Daytonas. They altered them. They screwed down the frequency back to 28,800 from a 36,000. But everybody refers to that generation of Daytonas as the Zenith Daytonas. So is that marketing for Zenith? I think so. So as a marketing point of view, I would do it. But it's a two-sided, two-edged sword because it can also cut the wrong way. Because in my humble opinion, it now hurt Schwarz-Etienne that it seems that Ming as a watch brand is more popular than Schwarz-Etienne as a watch brand. I didn't hear any collector, but then again, who am I? I didn't hear a collector who said, hey, you know what? I bought a Ming. Wow, Schwarz-Etienne makes amazing calibers. Let me go buy a Schwarz-Etienne watch right now. And that's, I think, is the danger. But that being said, did Zenith sell more watches because Rolex Daytonas contained an El Primero movement? I don't know. So Nomos is adamant. I don't think they'll do it. They don't have the intention to do it. I think their biggest argument is we are growing as a brand. We need the full capacity of producing calibers for our own watches. And that's what Swatch Group initially said, right? When we had these huge antitrust lawsuits from the Swiss authority towards Swatch Group when they wanted to cut off all the other watch brands. And that sparked the whole Swiss industry to start making their own calibers. Same goes for Frédéric Constant. Frédéric Constant is interesting because they got bought by the Citizen Group. And Niels Echeding said on air, I don't have any intentions to supply our Frédéric Constant calibers to other brands. They're not being pushed by Citizen to source these calibers to other Citizen subsidiaries. What is interesting, La Jouperet is part of the Citizen Group. And I believe that we just saw a first novelty by Frédéric Constant where they incorporated the G100 caliber by La Jouperet instead of ETA calibers. So you will see that. But Niels says, hey, I need my own production of calibers. Hey, he's been asked this many times ever since they launched their monolithic caliber. So those are my two long sins. Sorry for hijacking the mic.
No, it's fine. It is a complicated issue and you raised some good points now. I'm going to try and address them in some kind of order. You're absolutely right. Nomos and Freddie C are maybe different discussions because one is an independent, that's Nomos, and one is part of a bigger group. So as Swatch claimed, and as Nomos would say at this point, supply is a big issue. Do the brands in question have enough of a surplus to provide watches for other brands? Moreover, do they have the capacity to service those watches if they're coming back? Now, you can train a brand that you're supplying, I suppose, to start their own workshop. But when a brand starts supplying movements in that way, especially in this day and age, their reputation will also be hinged on the behavior of the brand they're selling those movements to. So this goes to your second point, I think. Branding. You say Ming has outgrown Schwarz-Etienne. I would not say that's a bad thing for Schwarz-Etienne. I think the worst thing that could happen is if a brand tanked with their movement in it and gave the movement manufacturer a bad reputation. Schwarz-Etienne makes beautiful movements. Unfortunately, they rarely make beautiful watches, in my opinion. They have done some collaborations with Kari Ritalainen's. Was it Combulin? Is it called the dial manufacturer? And those were beautiful. They did several series with several different brands, several media partners, several outlets, and they were really, really nicely done dials with excellent movements within them. That's another great thing for a brand like Schwarz-Etienne to do. We're talking about whether or not Nomos or Frédéric Constant could do it because they are, in comparison to Schwarz-Etienne, a volume producer. But if you look at the service times of many independent brands right now, they clearly don't have the capacity to really be considering that. I would be interested if a brand like Nomos had very few German partners, carefully selected, curated. Leica would be a perfect match, in my opinion, because they're not going to be making a huge amount of watches. The brands align stylistically. Nomos could either train Leica to have a small workshop service in their pieces or take them in themselves, although the service times are at the moment quite high because it's a very small team in Glaceter and they have a lot of watches out there and they're making thousands and thousands more every year and sending them out to the market. But that would make sense to me. David, what are your thoughts on this?
So I have a mix of thoughts based on what you both said, but I fall firmly into they should sell to brands camp. And I guess I'll work through all of those as best I can. So before the show, we were kind of talking about what the questions we were going to answer were. And just very briefly, I had this flash of a comment that I forget if it was Mr. Hayek Sr. or Jr. that said this, but the whole rationale for cutting off the Swiss watch industry from ETA movements was that we don't want to be financing our own competition. And I know this is different because we're talking about a movement supplier versus an actual brand here, but I think it's going to tie in well to my next set of comments. And what I thought when that quote came to mind was that if he didn't want to finance his own competition, why would he cut off the cash flow? Like, in other words, you know, I love playing pretend CEO and maybe I just don't know what the issues, I don't fully grasp them. But like, rather than cutting off supply, just double or triple the price for an ETA movement. So then what you would do is you would shut out all of the brands that were just going to make like, you know, cheap, throw them out the door watches. You get the ones who are really serious about adding to the industry and you would get everyone hooked on ETA movements and just bring in more cash flow for the company. So that then brings me to my next point about now individual brands going about this. And I think there's a broader discussion here because a lot of watch fans will say, you know, I wish the industry was more creative. I wish we'd kind of stray from established design codes. But you can't, I don't think, hold that opinion fully if you're then going to say, well, a watch only counts if it has an in-house movement, because you're cutting off so much potential creativity. So I think from a growth perspective, it's good that brands can and do share some of this really critical technology for a watch. Then just kind of tying everything together in terms of a good financial decision. Now, obviously, you know, when companies make decisions, and certainly when they're Swiss and private, they tend to be very secretive. They have other motives than just chasing, you know, cash flow or stock price. But if we accept that every company wants to make money to an extent, it just makes sense to sell these movements. The idea being that you have your established set of watches with obviously the proprietary calibers that go into them, but then maybe you sell a part of that proprietary caliber or a toned down version of it. So Pecunier, a French brand, has done this recently. They have some very complicated calibers. They're going to sell a more limited number of more simple calibers for use in watches. And that's a brand that's coming out of bankruptcy relatively recently. So it just makes sense, right? Because if you charge high enough, you can get the cash flow. You cannot sell to brands who are going to maybe misrepresent your movement. And ultimately, everyone wins. And the last comment I'll make, because I see we have two sets of hands up here, is that Vaucher, now I have no relation, this as far as I know, to the Vaucher manufacturer, but they make calibers for Hermes and other brands. They also sell their own calibers, and they will even make a fully custom designed watch for you if you want it. And that seems to have been to their profit in the last couple of years. So there is a model that it works. And yeah, overall, I think more sharing is good. And just, you know, it's good for individual brands to share their IP this way. Okay, I will throw it over to you two now.
You know, I can't fault your logic from a business perspective. That's something you're always very good at, shining a light on those opportunities there. And yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. If I was going to make a case for Swatch Group selling its movements elsewhere, I'd say, yeah, control the market. Don't look at it as selling to your competition. Look at it as having your competition in your back pocket almost. But we've been living through a really weird era of watchmaking. We've discussed it ad nauseum. It's discussed on every other podcast, every other blog, every magazine around the world, how we've got away from the original structure of the watch industry, which used to be a very collaborative effort. You'd have a case maker, you'd have a glass maker, you'd have a dial maker, you'd have hand makers, you'd have movement specialists. They'd all come together under a label and produce a watch. Nobody was ever bothered about doing everything in-house under one roof. And really, in my opinion, nor should they be. But the last 15, 20 years have become this race for in-house production, which I think motivated the Swatch Group's decision to try and ring fence its own calibers for itself, which they've done relatively successfully, and forced other brands to either develop their own stuff or new movement manufacturers, specialists like Chronod or Concepto to like really not pop up, but to develop and grow and have a new place in the market. I'd like to get back to that a little bit more. I'd like to go back to, say, Chapek is doing it in a pretty good way, which is pitched as a revolution, but it's actually just a reversion to the norm. They work with multiple partners. They don't really make anything themselves. You know, they assemble the watches themselves, but they buy their movements in. I really buzz off that era of Rolex with Zenith calibers in there. As a watch fan, I love it. Like, I think that it's great to have that partnership. Like, David, you love the Ralph Lauren stuff with the old Cartier movements in it, for example. It's cool. It's something to talk about. It doesn't have to be, oh, this is all made in-house. Because in-house comes with so many of its own problems as well. Especially like future-proofing your watches, getting them serviced. What if these calibers, which are made for so few watches, go out of production? What if the company goes out of production? You know, having a centralized movement supplier has many, many, many benefits. And yeah, I would like to see it happen more, but very, very carefully chosen partners, I think. So something of a blend between the old and the new.
I actually wanted to discuss this topic with you, David, specifically about French watchmaking. So I visited the Munich in Horgenta trade fair a few weeks ago, and they had an awesome pavilion for French watchmakers, Swiss watchmakers, Japanese, etc. So I finally encountered Yema watches in my hands. And I'm saying this a bit sarcastically or pun intended. I suspect them of making watches just to push calibers. So I ask you, is Yamaha, first and foremost, a caliber manufacturer or watchmaker? Are they both? And more importantly, what do you think their strategy is?
That's a super insightful comment. Like, they're making watches to sell calibers. But I guess, let me back up. So without having the history kind of on hand, Yamaha was a very well-known French watch brand prior to the quartz crisis. And actually, you know, this is something I always try and learn more about, but France played a pivotal role in the development of watches and even the development of Swiss watches, if you go back far enough in history. So Yamaha hit some bad times, as did a lot of other French brands. And in the last couple of years, they've come back. And in terms of French watchmaking, there have been a couple of initiatives that I've heard of. One is Francis Bouche, I think, is starting their manufacture up. And they were Francis Bouche in the 60s, 70s. They were making calibers. I think they went bankrupt, came back as another brand, which the name escapes me. I think that disappeared. Now they're Francis Bouche. They're making calibers again. Pequignet is a brand that was started in the 70s, I believe. They went up market. They're now selling, as I said earlier, a small amount of their Calibre Royal, just the simple three-hand version. And then we get to Yamaha. So Yamaha has been for a while advertising in-house movements. Now, I own a model called the Flygraph M2, which I like a lot. And they claim that it has an in-house movement in it. So I went and did some research. This was about a year and a half ago when I bought it. And I thought it was just a 2824 clone. And it seems like there might be some more differences than that. But since then, they have done quite a few things. They've made a Tourbillon watch. And the one that's getting a lot of interest now is they have a micro rotor. I forget the name of the caliber, but it appears in their Urban Traveler watch. And it seems to me like that is a direction that they're going. And one of the interesting things is that these calibers don't seem to add that much to the cost of the watch. So my assumption, I don't know this for sure, is that they are designed in France and then sent over to China to then be manufactured. So I have not heard that they're, maybe you've heard differently, Alan. I've not heard that they're going to make these available. But if they do, I would be all for it, because there are some other French brands, like Leap is another one, which is historically relevant. But I mean, they're using Miyota calibers now. I don't think it really reflects what the brand used to be. So if, you know, Yamaha wants to grow itself by making calibers available, I say more power to them. And just really quickly, because I've been talking a while, the point about having limited capacity to make these calibers, I think, well, first, that goes away if these are being outsourced. And I don't think that's a bad thing in this case. But the other thing, too, is just from a business point of view, is let's say that a brand like Yamaha, for example, maxes out its capacity selling movements. I take that as a signal, like expand capacity, increase your cash flow. So I think there's always this potential, if you start small, to build up and ultimately build for the business. But I definitely, a lot of things said, Alan. I think it's hugely interesting. And I think when you talk about like the revival of the whole industry in France, I think that depends on sharing, which I think is great going forward.
So I got the vibe that it's very important for the French to revive Besançon, French watchmaking. It's super important to them that it's manufactured and they're pushing the calibers. And that begs the question, and I asked them that also, do you have non-French brands buying French calibers? So it's interesting to see what that market does. Now, I think it's an amazing move, very welcome. And Seven Friday, who we've interviewed recently, Dan Niederer, so definitely check that episode. He broke the mold for Swiss brands using non-Swiss calibers, right? But he broke the mold using Miyotas. And we've seen Baltic using Chinese calibers and different Japanese, Chinese. Underdog is using Seagull. So I think it's a very good timing to revive French in-house watchmaking, and you referred to Pékinet. I think Pékinet was too early with the Royale. So they had bad timing, but good idea.
Okay. That turned out to be a rather expansive answer, and I think we could probably do a whole show on it. But let's pivot, for the sake of variety, to another question in the mailbag. This one comes from Bernd, one of our newer listeners, actually. Picked up the show a few weeks ago, and he's been going all the way back through the back catalogue, which is very much appreciated. Thank you for the listens and for the attention. And he has sent us several questions. We're going to pick up one here because it's relevant to what we've just been discussing. He is talking about a show we did a while ago when we discussed thickness. And he says, I wondered why there was no mention in the show of the impact of the use of movements in regard to thickness. He would like to give the example of the Omega Seamaster 300M. Interestingly, after replacing the ETA 2892-based Omega caliber, which was originally known as the 1120, and then the 2500, which had A, B, C, and D versions with the addition of the coaxial escapement and different components surrounding it to make sure that it functioned properly. If anyone's wondering, my personal favorite is the C. The D is completely different and kind of wild, but the C was the one that actually worked. When he replaced that caliber with a new in-house one, it got thicker. Bernd is not entirely sure, but it could have been the same with the Black Bay, as the ETA 2824 had a thickness of 4.6 and the Tudor MT5602 roughly 2 millimeters more. He thinks it's interesting that the Rolex Tudor argument could still hold true, and that choices of movement architecture can also be down to the flexibility for adding complications and also the reliability and the serviceability of them thereafter. Now, the question is, how often are brands considering movement thickness when it comes to building a watch, and what are the reasons brands might choose to use certain movements in certain designs? Does anyone want to take this one away? Do I see any hands popping up? I see David there. Go ahead, mate.
Rob, I mean, I think I'm going to provide a lot of importance to your comments because you've worked in the field, but I've worked in manufacturing. And to answer the question, like how much thought is put to thickness, I mean, all the time. These are such complicated things to make that I would be shocked if it was like all of, you know, the complications were put on there. It was kind of the architecture was decided. And then in the end, someone just accepted like, okay, that makes our movement, you know, 3 millimeters thick or whatever it is. Like, I just can't imagine that not being one of the absolute like guiding constraints making these things, just because there is so much to go with them. And so Rob, your hand did go up. One last thing I'll say is that, you know, I mentioned this on one of the thickness discussions we had before, just using the Rolex and Tudor example here. A watch is it's an object that is designed with a purpose and an audience in mind. So if one is thicker relative to the other, there's a reason for that. Now, we may not know all the time what those reasons are, but there's a reason. So, Rob, what do you think?
I mean, you're 100% correct. The movement is an absolutely essential architectural component to the watch. It doesn't exist in isolation of any other component that it touches, and it touches pretty much all the important ones, the dial, the hands, the case. And most importantly, perhaps, for the choice of the thickness, it touches the crown. So, although the movement is an internal component, you can't really hide it as well as you might think. If you come into the industry cold, you might think, oh, I'll stick whatever movement I want in there. It makes no difference. The crown is always going to give away where the movement sits. Now, nowadays, we see a lot more consideration in this because watches are made for a more discerning audience than has ever been in existence before. What's interesting, though, is it wasn't always this way. And you could often see when brands had, say, a surplus of a movement, and they were trying to chase certain market trends, like they wanted bigger watches, but they had a bunch of old, smaller movements that didn't fit them. So they'd close the case back and they'd try and hide it away in the middle of this massive watch. But the problem was often the crown would be in a weird position. Like it might sit too high in order to keep the dial close enough to the glass for it to not look ridiculous. You know, you would often find when people were trying to save money using modular calibers, where they have like a load of base calibers in stock and they stick a Dubois Dupré chronograph module on top, obviously the crown shifts down in the case. And you can always tell a modular chronograph when you hold it up and you look at it from the side, you can see that the crown and the pushers are actually towards the lower half of the case rather than bang slap in the middle where you would expect them to be with an integrated chronograph movement. So there are massive considerations, things you cannot get away from, and the importance of it cannot be overstated. If you wanted, for example, to, let's take something like the Black Bay. Let's take the Black Bay and say, okay, you start off with a caliber that's 2 millimeters thinner than the one that you want to ultimately upgrade to. If you've designed that watch with an eye on the long-term future, then obviously you would have to do some weird things to make sure its aesthetics didn't change after changing the movement from one that's 2 millimeters thicker. The most obvious thing is you have to increase the thickness of the dial and then the hand height. Now, most movements have the option of H1, H2, H3, H4 hand height. There's normally four standard hand heights which can account for thicker dials. It is possible to step these things up further and further and further, but there is a limit at which point the weight of the hand will affect the optimization of the movement's performance, because you can't have a hand that weighs a ton. This is particularly true in quartz modules. It's less of a problem with mechanical because they have higher torque, but with quartz modules, you have to be really careful about the hand weight. You can't have a hand that's too heavy. For example, on a chronograph seconds hand on a quartz module, it'll just break off its stem, or, you know, slip out of alignment, or cause the wheel to jump at a sequence, so the teeth will step back and your hand zeroes at -5. So there's all sorts of considerations to make when you're building the watch. It's absolutely integral to the design of a watch, in my opinion. Like David says, if it's there, there's normally a reason for it.
So Bernd, welcome. Bedankt dat je luistert naar de show. Bernd, thank you so much. Welcome to have you on the show. Awesome question. And thank you for listening to all the old episodes of TRTS. You might have picked up that I've been raving about Rob. I do that often. Not too often, because he already has too much of a big head. But he does some great things. And one of them, which made him mythical, iconic in my mind.
Stop it. Stop it now. It's too much. My head's only 58.6 centimeters, by the way. It's just, I've got a small body.
What's the size of your fitted baseball caps?
Well, I've actually got to go up to 7 3/8 now. They were 7 1/4, but then my hair grew. So please don't ask me.
Hair or your head? Hence, my theory works. So,
you know, you keep blowing smoke up my ass with this VII nonsense.
You know that I always say, if you have real baseball caps and if you're OG, you have woolen ones. And if you wash them, it seems your head grows. You know, my first ever fitted New Era New York Yankees cap, when I was a kid, I bought it in New York because you couldn't get fitted caps in Europe. And my mom washed it one time, so I flipped it, shrunk, but I always kept it. So I'm actually keeping it for my son right now. So it's vintage. Talking about vintage stuff, not only watches are cool vintage, but no patina on them because the cap, because it's washed. Anyways, I'm deviating. So big heads, Rob rightfully so has a big head.
Will you stop it now, for goodness sake?
It is annoying for David and I, because that big head comes with a whip, and oh my gosh, if we do something wrong, oh my gosh, you hear. Anyways, Bernd, VII, Visual Impact Index. Google it. Rob wrote an amazing article about it, and it is a very valid point. So selling your soul as a watch brand and killing models for just sake of using standard calibers is a sacrilege, actually. Rob, am I right to say that a bit more quality is always exponential in price? A bit thinner and more elegant is also exponential in price. And could we also add another one-liner and therefore theory? The bigger the calibers, the thicker, the sturdier they are. So is that why Tudor makes thicker calibers and it's lower in price compared to their Rolex siblings or cousins? And it helps them to make it also bigger because it's sturdy. It can endure more, take more shocks and impacts. Are these things correct to say?
Yes and no. Broadly speaking, yeah. But I mean, there's no absolute rule. Like, you know how people used to think the heavier a watch was, the better quality it was. You know, it's not really a direct metric. Of course, you can have something like a Ploprof in steel, and it's heavy and it's robust and it's indestructible, and, you know, its weight is a sign of that. But then you could also just have a big lump from TW steel, and it's not really indicative of quality. And, you know, it's not better quality than a Bertrand Mirage, for example. So Gracility in movements, thinness, yes, it's difficult. Obviously, we know it is. And the main reason for it is due to the flexibility of the components and the end shake that you have between the wheels and the jewels. So the end shake is how much up and down play you have on a wheel between the two jewels upon which it bears. You need to have a little bit of wiggle room, not so much that the teeth can disengage from the wheel it touches in the gear train, but enough so that it doesn't get jammed up or clamped down upon when the bridge is tightened in place. Now, with very, very fine components, something like a record set in Piaget or Bulgari, the plates are so thin, even the breath from the watchmaker assembling them can deform them enough to crush the end shape to a point at which the gear train no longer runs. So when you have a thicker caliber and you have more robust bridge feet, for example, and it's locked very firmly in place and you've got extremely bankable end shakes, yes, it can survive more impact. It's less likely to move. The wheels are less likely to sustain a shock that will jump them out of sequence or cause them to jam up against one another. But it's not necessarily like a hard and fast rule. So you can have pretty slim calibers now that are very affordable. There's a brand, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it's a micro rotor brand from Hong Kong that makes quite attractive movements for not very much money at all. And they're very slim. They're only about 3 millimeters thick, which is pretty tiny. I mean, the Nomos DUW3001 is 3.2 millimeters tall, I think. And that is about as slim as an automatic caliber can be without being subject to those flexibilities that cause issues. It's a really remarkably built caliber, very nicely done and very reliable. Something like Tudor, like the MT series movements or anything from Canisi, for example, is totally rock solid. They do have great chronometric performance as well. I believe that they are, what is it, 0 and +4 for the MTs, or is it -4, +4? Something along those lines. It's extremely good. It's tighter than Kosk, and that is something they're very proud of. They actually regulate Canisi movements in-house. I don't know if you know this, but there are only very few brands that are allowed to use those Canisi movements outside of Tudor and Chanel, and they are, let's see now, Breitling can use them, Norcane can use them. There's one I'm forgetting, but the other one that I know very well is Fortis. Two of Fortis's models have Canisi movements. Their GMT models have them, and their Marine Master M44 models have them. And Fortis will say quite openly that they're not allowed to re-regulate those movements once they get them from Canisi. They come regulated, and they are not to be touched before they go into the watch. So they're very particular about it, and they have a great deal of faith in their ability to maintain those timekeeping parameters, regardless of the shocks they might experience.
Yeah, just wanted to add, Rob, all good points, but just to complete your thought on brands being allowed to use Canisi, one brand that I mentioned when I did a Q&A with Alan was Ultramarine Watches, so I don't think anyone's heard of it, but somehow they were able to use Canisi movements. So going back to our earlier question, maybe they're expanding. But yeah, add that to the list of brands that work those calibers into their watches.
That's bonkers. There's actually one more as well that it's just slipped in my mind for some reason. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure it'll come back to us at some point. But that's crazy. Maybe Canisi are starting to branch out a little bit. I mean, why not, right? I mean, it's a great movement. It's a great product. They're quite attractive. They're not gorgeous, but they're certainly my kind of thing, you know, robust, rugged. I'm all for it. What do you think, Alan?
I agree. And what was interesting, to circle back to Bernd's question about iconic models becoming too thick, because I read that in between the lines, is that Tudor is listening to the market. So they indeed became thicker when they moved away from ETA to manufacture Canisi movements. You can spot them, because the old Tudor models, when on the 6 o'clock position, the whole spiel, the whole text, the Bible text with chronometer, automatic, blah, 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 is a smiley. Those are bought calibers. So let's say ETA's. If it's a straight line, the text is straight, it's manufactured. Now, the move for the Burgundy Black Bay 41. So that's the OG, the first one that Davide Serrato created, I believe, 11 years ago. It first had a rose, smiley, dumped the rose, then became manufactured with Canisi, straight lines. And now the current one launched last year, is MITAS certified. And they went a bit slimmer. So they listened to the market, but they can't do so much because of the caliber. So interesting topic. Thank you for the question, Bernd. Thank you, Rob, for schooling us. Nobody does it better than you, Rob. So the mic is yours.
Excellent question, Bernd. Thank you for being part of the Real Time Show family. We're really proud to have you as a listener. Please do continue to listen. As we mentioned at the top of the show, the frequency of episodes will reduce now to one a week and going out on Sundays in the morning. So get yourselves out of bed, take the dog for a walk, brew yourself a nice pot of coffee and sit down and enjoy some top quality watch chat. If you'd like to be involved in the show, if you'd like to ask us questions or give us any kind of feedback at all, then please do get in touch. You can do so via our dedicated Instagram handle. That's @therealtime.show or via any of our personal handles, either @DAVAUCHER for David, @ALONBENJOSEPH for Alon, or @ROBNUDDS for me. You can contact either Alon or me via our email addresses, either Rob or Alon @therealtime.show, or via the contact form on the website, www.therealtime.show. And do make sure to check out the website in the next couple of weeks, because it will be getting a complete overhaul and things are going to look very different going forward. We can't wait for you to come on this adventure with us. Until next time, stay safe and keep on ticking.